name's John Radwin. I direct our Institute for Communication and Religion, and I'm honored to be part of the Contemplative Community Initiative that's putting on our Peace Workshop today. The title for my talk today is Howard Thurman on Reconciliation, Inciting Peace from the Inside Out. And if anybody would like to download my slides, especially because they're a little bit crowded today, so if you're sitting at the back, it might be hard to read some of the text. The university has a nice BPress site for faculty, so it's works.bpress.com/John_Radwin. That's my name. And so for my attention getter, please be honest. How many of you know anything about Howard Thurman? I got one strong hand, one somewhat hand, and a lot of honest people. You're not alone. I did not know about Howard Thurman before last year. I am learning a lot about him, and it's deep and amazing. And so I'm going to do my best today to try to introduce you to his thoughts on reconciliation and how it works from interiority, from our hearts, outward toward our community. And so here we go. I'll do about 20 minutes of talk, and then we'll do about 20 minutes of trying to practice the meditation that he recommends. And then I'll try to leave 20 or 15 minutes at the end for some Q&A so we can interact together. So here's my main idea. According to Howard Thurman, there's only one place where reconciliation comes from. It comes from inner peace. If you've got a heart that's turbulent and full of strife, you're really not prepared to reconcile and build bridges. So inner peace is a priority. It's the root of all reconciliation. And so then how do we do that? Well, Howard's recommendation is to change the tempo of your life, to try to slow down. And then how do you do that? You start to develop a meditative or prayer life. That is the step that gets you over all of those busy things driving your heart and mind, sometimes kind of crazy. Things like pride, like judging other people, like why don't they get on board? Why don't they do better stuff? And instead of worrying about them, Howard's recommendation is work on yourself. Work on getting your own heart still. Work on getting your own heart peaceful. When you've got that strong heart that's peaceful, you can start to do miraculous things. And so violence, this is the verb he puts with it. The goal for violence is not to fight it back, fight back against it, not to eradicate it. If you want violence to go away in your society, work on a heart that can actually absorb that violence, that can pull it out of the social realm and kind of capture it and stifle it in your own loving heart. And then another wonderful verb he uses is gentled. So what do you do with a hater? Lots of people would say, well, I just try to avoid the haters because they're dangerous and mean. And Howard's recommendation is if you get that peaceful, still heart, you can share some of that peace. And the haters are the people who need your help the most. They're the ones that you can work to gentle. And then how's all this stuff happening? It's happening by renouncing really basic human things. We're renouncing the fight or flight instinct. So fear is something that we have to get over. And then retaliation is not how you need violence. It goes back to that absorption theme. So that's when we can start to, when we got that heart that's still in a good place with God, that's when we can start to reach out to people, including the people who need it most, the oppressors, and give them the gift of ourselves. We can give them our care, our patience, and our understanding. So this is my main idea, and I will repeat it back at the end. And my next slide here is just a little bit of background on Howard's life, because so few of us have studied him before. He's really interesting. He spans almost the entire 20th century, and is an amazing Black spiritual leader for almost all of it. So here's a picture of his high school graduation picture around 1919. Handsome young man who is, at least what I interpret, he's looking directly at the camera. It says to me that he's ready for something. And then he's ready for a pretty amazing life. So he's born into the segregated South in Florida. And Waycross is one of the three 100% black neighborhoods in Daytona, Florida. And then some of you were here for Reverend Pritchett's talk before. The church is a major life institution in the black American experience. So his church, the Bethel Baptist Church, not Bethel Baptist Church, is extremely influential on him and his family. So he's born into segregation, similar to what Reverend Pritchett was describing before. He loses his father at a very young age. His grandmother was born into slavery, and so she's still sharing those experiences with him. As he grows up a little bit, he's academically talented. And this is still the early 20th century segregated South, so there's no place nearby that he can go to high school. So 100 miles away, he goes to one of the only three black high schools in Florida. And so this one's in Jacksonville, Florida Baptist Academy. And that's at the end of that period, that's when this picture is taken. That's his high school graduation picture. As he heads off to college, he goes to Morehouse in Atlanta, Georgia, historically black college, and he excels. He's the valedictorian. That's kind of not enough. He's also so great that he heads north, goes to the Rochester Seminary, and is also valedictorian there. So he's an intellectual and spiritual star, a hero, somebody succeeding all over the place. That gets him a job out of school. So he's a professor at a very young age, right? 27 years old. He's already a professor of philosophy and religion back at his alma mater, Morehouse University in Atlanta, Georgia. When we get to the 30s, this is where he really takes off. The Howard University is the historically black college in Washington, D.C. It's not technically the name one, but sort of the name one because it's in Washington, D.C. He's the first dean of the chapel there. And so it's not just that he's a teacher, he's a preacher. Every Sunday, he's delivering pretty legendary sermons. And then I don't quite want to say he invented podcasting, but he's a 20th century person who understood the importance of electronic media. So not all of them, but most of his sermons are recorded and are pretty easy to find online nowadays. Just do a search for Howard Thurman audio and you'll be overwhelmed by how many sermons you can, So today you're hearing me talk about him. You can hear him speak in his own voice. You can hear his lessons from his own mouth. One of the most fascinating things he did in the 1930s is he responded to an invitation and led a pilgrimage to India to learn from Gandhi. This is just legendary and influential. The entire nonviolent, or almost the entire nonviolent philosophy of the American Civil Rights Movement grows out of Howard Thurman meeting with Gandhi, finding out how India works toward justice and civil rights for people, and bringing those lessons back to the United States and teaching them and preaching them. He's not just a teacher and a preacher, he's also somebody who makes things happen. So in the 1940s, the war years, he moves out to California to co-found the first fully integrated Baptist church. So black parishioners and white parishioners together in a large legendary church, and he's a co-founder. So there's a white preacher right there alongside him. They're giving us a model of something that hopefully a lot of us take for granted nowadays, that church is not segregated, church should be everybody coming together. He's the first one that actually does it. And then back to his teaching and mentorship. In the 50s, he takes a position at Boston University, and he's the dean of the chapel, so he both preaches and teaches there. And again, if you listen to Reverend Pritchett's speech, you would know that that's where MLK is learning. So, and really there's family relationships too. So Howard Thurman did know MLK's father, so that's part of the connection. So MLK is directly mentored by this amazing, wise person who's learned from Gandhi all about how nonviolent, peaceful protest is an ethical way to fix society, to improve it. And then for his retirement and the end of his life, as I mentioned, he's lots of his stuff is available nowadays. The reason why it's so available is he had several years of retirement with lots of supporters and resources. So they started an educational trust, and now Thurman's books, and especially the audio, lots of it's available free online, and I encourage you all to check it out. So that's my setup for who we're talking about today. Howard Thurman, student of Gandhi, mentor to MLK, and wise person who helps me understand how to move toward peace, and I hope you all can understand a little bit of it today too. So we're working with his ideas about reconciliation. And this is a pretty famous picture. Does anybody recognize this rhesus monkey? Okay, I can teach you this one too. If you're a psych major, you might have run into this one before. In the 20th century, there was a lot of experimentation done on animals. We didn't quite have, we experimented on people too through the 20th century. For the animal studies, they're trying to figure out how human behavior works. And so we're primates, so let's study the monkeys. Let's see how they work. What the this picture was taken at the University of Wisconsin in the 50s and 60s, they did these experiments. What they're trying to do is find out what's that bottom level of humanity, what's required to be a human being. And they start to find out really fascinating things. And then remember, Howard Thurman is from the same period. So Howard Thurman is a smart, wise man. He's up to date on current research on primates. He wanted a pretty neat experiment. So for this experiment, they're saying, what will happen to an infant rhesus monkey if we take away his mom? And so, surprise, most of them die when you just take away the mom. The idea they move from there is, well, how do we give it food, right? And so again, they're experimenting, they're messing with the poor baby monkeys, and they give them choices. They give a mom-shaped doll, which is the image on the right here, and then you could also get your food from a doll that's kind of not very mom-shaped. It's more made out of wire, it doesn't have any soft surfaces, it doesn't really have eyes. And then kind of surprisingly, the monkeys that do pick this mom-shaped doll, they start to be able to survive. Without any actual care, they kind of get virtual care through a doll. And so that's a little bit of the setup. I'm going to come back to those experiments. But again, that's part of why I'm so impressed with Howard Thurman. He's not just a theologian. He's not just a religious scholar. He's somebody who studied psychology, somebody who studied anthropology, and is up to date on the research from his era. So my main focus today is reconciliation. And Thurman says the only way to reconcile, the only way to give peace is to start getting over yourself and not be about your selfish desires. Instead, start to be about giving, how you give away. This is one of the vocab words in theology. Thurman is known as a mystic. He's someone who very deeply believes that there's a fundamental unity for all life. So any division, any separation is an illusion or a human effort to break God's divine unity. And so I'd say even the unity with the poor rhesus monkeys, right? They're not separate from us, something we experimented on. They're part of life. And so here's a quote that gets at the connection between mysticism and reconciliation. Thurman has what we call a holistic mystical perspective. The quality of reconciliation, getting along, getting over problems, getting over conflict, is that of wholeness. It seeks to affect and further harmonious relations in a totally comprehensive climate. So he's thinking of the country as an atmosphere, a climate, and through the 20th century, especially in his experience, it's clearly not harmonious, right? He's born into segregation, he's working through all the strife of the civil rights era. And so how do you face up to those internal and external conflicts, right? The external conflicts are, you know, haters coming at you and oppressing you. The internal conflicts are maybe some questioning or guilt, like how do I face that, or why haven't I faced that yet? The way to face it, according to Thurman, is to start thinking about wholeness. His second kind of anthropological observation, and this is coming back to the rhesus monkeys, is as they study primates, they start to learn that humans are not solo beings. When you think about it nowadays, it's pretty logical, right? You don't come out of nowhere and you can't exist alone. You're coming out of a family. We're always born in relation, and then we grow as we develop those relationships. So Eric Byrne is the psychologist I like to cite on this one. He doesn't cite Eric Byrne, but I do. It's being recognized by your fellow human beings. It's just simply not optional. In the same way that air isn't optional or food isn't optional, we need people to connect with us. We need people to recognize us as, on the basic level, even worthy of attention, right? So like extreme discrimination takes away that recognition. Somebody is recognized only for like the smallest part of their being, like labor. And then genuine recognition is when you're starting to take into account that whole person. And then as somebody does that for you, as they pay attention to you, as they give you care, you're starting to be fed. Your soul, your heart is nourished by that attention from your fellow human being. So again, here's the monkey stuff. They figured out at the University of Wisconsin in the mid-20th century that nurture, even if it's this kind of super basic, sad nurture, like from a doll, that's that first step into knowing that you're a person. It's the first step into knowing that somebody is caring for you. And so you're separate from them, you're not them, but you're somebody worthy of that nurture. And then Thurman dwells quite a bit on this one. Nurture isn't quite enough. Unfortunately, you can have sociopathic monkeys if you only give them nurture. If you just give them that doll and some food and then surprise them by throwing them into a group of monkeys, they're not going to know how to deal with that. They're going to unfortunately get violent or completely withdraw. So the studies end up saying it only takes 20 minutes a day for the infant monkeys, but 20 minutes a day as they learn to experience themselves through play, through engaging their playmates, that's healthy monkey psychology. You have a mother level, even most basic mother level, a soft surface and some food, and then a more complex social level where you've got socialization. That's the fundamentals for primate existence. And then don't forget the bigger lesson, we're primates, right? We need these things too. We clearly need nurture. We also need socialization. We need to engage one another in play situations. So the gift idea starts to head out of science into more spirituality. The idea here is that you can build bridges. You have a fairly amazing power to change patterns. So how can you do that? Well, you start to pay attention to each other, right? And find out that everybody needs this, but we have different support systems and different experiences, so some of us need it more than others. And arguably, the haters or the violent people need it the most. So taking a look at the other person and trying to sense and honor their fundamental primate needs, their need to be cared for and understood, starts to be that first miraculous step toward reconciliation. It's amazing because one person can do it. You can stand in your own place, be yourself, and pay attention to the soul of the other people, not the surface of the other person, deep down inside what they need. And you can begin to get at some of those verbs I described before. So this one is using that gentle verb. How do you gentle the hate out of the hater? Well, it's definitely not going to be done with arguing with them and fighting with them, but it can be done if you've got some inner peace and you're willing to share some of that inner peace in a situation of love and care. You're acknowledging that they need that. And so calling the hater a needy person sounds almost inverted. This is the type of wisdom that Howard is teaching me, and I hope you're getting at some of it. Don't worry, we'll have Q&A at the end. Praxis is what you do. and so praxis is plural. And Thurman looks at society and sees two basic practices for how society runs. Some of them are violent, like slavery and oppression. Others are nonviolent, like he was learning from Gandhi, the nonviolent and peaceful protest. When you study physical force, when you study the violent practices, it's pretty simple. The violent person thinks that they can get you to do what they want. They think that they can get you to capitulate. So they're imposing their will on you, such as, like Reverend Bridges' example, working for no money, right? So you can physically force somebody to do that. Thurman's lesson here is this is always temporary. You never have a sustainable pattern if you have force, especially state force, making human beings do things, because we're inherently free. It might last a while, but nobody's going to put up with that over time. And then back to trying to understand hater psychology. Why are they doing that? They actually really need care. They need attention. They need help. And they can't, for whatever reason, get it a healthy way. So they're forcing people to bend to their will rather than engaging in a healthy way. So as the hater hates, they're trying to insulate themselves from their fellow human beings, but we know from the monkey studies that you really kind of can't insulate yourself from your community. The only reason why we exist is because we live in community. Humans are relational beings. And then on top of all that physical stuff, Thurman, and this is my home field of communication, Thurman reminds us that there's also non-physical violence. So as we lie to one another or break promises, they're parallel moves, right? They're damages to our relationships. The nonviolent praxis is completely different. The nonviolent praxis says when somebody's coming at you, when somebody is hating on you, when somebody's sending a violent act your way, instead of retaliating, which is a really basic animal instinct, so it takes a lot of spiritual wisdom to get over it, but that's his recommendation. Get over your instincts and instead recognize that that person coming at you has needs. That person needs care. And if you work at your heart, you can meet that need. You can absorb that violence. So again, it's not about traditional animal psychology. It says we have evolved past, or we can evolve past, the fight or flight response. What we can do is recognize that some people are going to try to act like animals and bring violence at us, but we can actually absorb their force out of a loving heart. So it takes a lot of work. And so here's how he describes it. We need deliberate training or disciplining of the nervous pattern of the organism to a new kind of response. That response answers the demand to absorb violence rather than to counteract it in kind. So rather than meet fire with fire, I take the fire into my heart and extinguish it there. And then of course, again, if you listen to Reverend Pritchett, you heard quite a bit about the fear theme. Violence wants you to be afraid. The hater is counting on your fear. That's the step toward control, right? So getting over our fears, it's challenging outside of a spiritual context, but within a spiritual context, the Bible is completely full of how this lifetime is not the lifetime to be worried about, and that this lifetime will have suffering and problems and travails, and the focus is on the kingdom of God, on eternity. So trying to get yourself over your fear of bodily harm is super tough. But this is one of the major lessons of peaceful protest in the civil rights movement is MLK's people, and you learn this from Thurman, they're doing spiritual discernment and training to ask themselves super tough questions like, can I be struck by a police officer and not strike back? Can I be bitten by a police dog and not run away in fear? If I can get myself to that level of spiritual strength and recognize that my body is really only temporary, the soul is the bigger picture, I can start to do pretty amazing things for society, even undermine the power of the violent haters. So this is what I was referencing with peace demonstration. And really, it's I think it's too rare nowadays in the MLK civil rights style. We have lots of spiritual information for people doing protests and demonstrations and so on. Nowadays, I want to say people's motives are good, but they maybe need a little bit of this training in how to actually, and this is the kind of provocative word for our title today, how do you incite peace? Like, most of us now know how to incite violence. You get people upset, and you give them some powerful words, and you give them a target, and you do it with enough energy, you could even incite a riot. How do you go the opposite direction? How do you almost cause peace, right? Like, incitement isn't a rational decision where you're saying, okay, if I attack them, I could go to that store over there. Inciting is something that's like of the body and heart, just gets you going. How do you go the opposite direction? How do you incite somebody toward peace? It comes back to that lesson of self-gift, that your safety isn't something for you to protect. Instead, your safety is something to offer up to the community. So as you do that, as I got a pretty powerful picture here on the right-hand side, right? So as the police officer is bringing the dogs to bear on the protester, and the protester, I hope you can see his face, he's not running away, he's not crying, he's there with he's happy about it, but he's not crying in fear, and he's not running away. That starts to wake up the oppressor. The oppressor, especially, armed ones, they're looking for a fight. They're trained for a fight. They know how to fight. So meeting force with force, you're almost always going to come out up against somebody who's better equipped and better trained than you, and that's going to be a massive disaster. So don't meet force with force, especially state force. Instead, try to meet it with what MLK ends up calling soul force. It forces the oppressor to think things through. Like, what the heck am I doing? I trained to fight against violent people, and you're not being violent. You're just standing there. What kind of horrible person am I to sick a dog on somebody who's just standing there? It, again, almost causes, or the verb for today's title is incites, reflection. It's maybe not every time, but definitely more times than more fighting, gets the oppressor to think things through and find another way. And so in MLK, his history, that this is the Bull Connor scenario, but this is about Howard Thurman today, so we can talk about Bull another day. But basically, oppressors can learn. And then how do they learn? They don't learn from fighting. They learn from peaceful resistance. And then for the bigger things, when it's not about that individual cop with those individual dogs, when it's the whole system, Thurman's recommendation there is to try to help everybody know that systems aren't separate from people. So personalize the system. Put a face to the system, or many, many faces to the system. That's what starts to awaken the public's conscience when they start to become aware that the system that we're all a part of is oppressive, it is evil. And we're all in this together is hopefully an outcome of peaceful protest. So we're all in this together does not come out of violent protest or fighting back, right? That's force against force. Instead, the nonviolent peaceful resistance says do all the non-force things. So it's a spiritual movement, so prayer and singing psalms. It's also a civil rights movement, so march, disobey at least some of the laws, like the great permit laws. Reverend Pritchett talked about the importance of sit-ins just in the last speech. Of course, there's boycott and occupy movements. Thurman even goes so far as to cite suicidal people as models of nonviolent resistance, which is pretty shocking in a Christian context, right? Most people are familiar that Christians don't like suicide. It's not a valid strategy according to the Bible. But Thurman points to a non-Christian example where there's a family in Africa, and the husband brings home the second wife without talking to the first wife about it, and she's trying to raise the kid. And so rather than fight with him, it's tragedy from my perspective, but she just opts out. I'm not going to be part of this family. I'm not going to be part of a polygamy system. And so he praises her for walking off a cliff with her child. And so that probably got the husband to think things through, right? Arguing with him, it's just going to be a challenge to his power, and he's more powerful, so he's looking for argument, he's ready to argue. Completely opting out and tragically taking the son with her forces him to think and maybe gets him to grow. The last bit for the talk part is how we can do this as a discipline. How could we bring it into our own lives? And then I'll transition out of this into an actual meditative practice where we try to do a little bit of it. So, how do you do it? Three steps. The first step is probably the hardest step because it takes getting over your own self. We tend to run our lives, especially in the United States, out of an attitude of individualism and putting number one first. The step that Thurman says we have to do is try to get out of that kind of judgment thing where you're not me, so you're not a priority. I'm working on my career. I'm working on my paycheck. I'm working on my knowledge. And start to think that justice is our primary intention. And justice is about how we relate peacefully to other people. It's reconciliation. So think about it for a minute, especially in family scenarios, but really almost everywhere. We're really good at giving ourselves a pass and really bad at giving anybody else acceptance. So we want to be accepted just as we are with all of our strengths and weaknesses. But when somebody else walks by, it's almost always, or it feels off too often, like a judgment scenario where it's time to point out their weaknesses. And, oh, I would help you if you were a better protester. But since you're really kind of not, and you're only doing this, that your motives are good and your methods are bad, I'm going to leave you alone. Well, that's not reconciliation. That leaves somebody on their own to do an almost impossible social thing. So Thurman's recommendation, which is a major biblical message, is get over your sin of pride. First recognize that almost all of us have it almost all the time. We're always into ourselves. We're always comfortable judging others. And so consider thinking through your life and repenting for that pride. Superiority and inferiority, that's the whole dynamic behind racism, right? So nobody deserves to be up on a pedestal. Everybody is equal. If you've ever thought that you were better than anybody else, this is the time to repent, according to the Christian tradition. And then if you do that, this tradition says, well, God's definitely going to forgive you. That's what's in the book. God's going to forgive you. That starts to awaken our own desires to love, that we could act like God does, that we could forgive people for their flaws, that we could get over judging people and get into forgiving people. This is a Latin phrase that he uses. We can stand in the place of God. So no, we're not God, we're still human. But we can stand in the place of God and give people what they really need. And then I hope you remember what they really need because we studied monkeys a few minutes ago. What do people really need? Connection, socialization, and nurture and care, love, right? That's what people need the most. And then especially the poor haters need it the most. Step two, and really that first step is the hardest step, it takes a long time. Step two is start to listen. Start to pay attention to your neighbors. Start to pay attention to the others. You've already done step one. You've gotten over your pride and judgments and are ready to stand in the place of God and give people what they need. Don't presume you already know what they need. Now the step is, communication, we call this audience analysis. And in systems theory, we call it identifying the interfaces. What are the connecting points? How can I connect with somebody who needs help? And then more on the internal side, what do I have to give? We all have different gifts and talents. So in the basic level, we can all give care and understanding. But sure, like what is that going to look like? Well, if you're an artist, care and understanding might come show up as an art form. If you're a teacher, care and understanding might show up as a lesson. So figuring out how to get out of yourself and into the other is not something quick. Instead, he says, use the power of your imagination. Really think it through, especially think through your relationship with the other person. And then really think about the other person. Put yourself in their shoes or in their mind. And so that's what we call empathy or perspective taking, when it's not just about you and your view and your judgment. It's what is going on to drive this hater to that hate? What perspective do they have that they think that is rational? After I do that for a while, then his lesson is, don't come at them with lessons and tell them what to do. Instead, just spend time with each other. And so the biblical word for this is to tarry with one another. Tarrying is like hanging out. It's spending time without necessarily trying to get anything done beyond just be there for one another. So that's his idea of the sense of leisure. It's not relaxation by yourself at home. It's relaxation, leisurely time, no rush, no push, with the people who need your care and attention. And it's not just for them. It's actually a mutual pattern, because it's helping grow your soul too. It's a mutual gift cycle. So the quote that brings this together is that mutual theme, where it's not just about helping you out because I'm so superior. It's that we both need one another to exercise our ability to love. And then remember that leisurely theme, that it takes time and deep reflection and listening to develop that unhurried, gentle soul and pattern of life that could actually help somebody out who needs help the most. I'm going to transition at this point from the lectury part into the meditative part. Everybody ready to actually try a little bit of this? Please raise your hand if you've ever meditated before. All right, so slightly few more than knew about Howard Thurman. Don't worry, I'm still a beginner at meditation too. I'm going to lead this one. Please consider following along the steps. So it does ask you to kind of tune out from your machines and just spend some time with your interiority and reflection. So here's my image of the sun coming out. We're out of the learning phase and into a phase where we actually practice some of what Howard says to do. The timing is key. So much of our lives is rush, rush, and busy. And so he's asking us to change the tempo of our life pattern. And not just once in a while, a profound alteration in the tempo. And so that's leisure time is used for silence, meditation, and prayer. That prepares the path toward love. So I'm going to lead a brief, what we call a centering meditation, and then we'll move into two guided images. Remember, Thurman said the power of your imagination is central. So, if you've never done this before, it's okay. The first step in meditation is to work on your posture. So I know you're all sitting. Now sit right. The way to sit right is balanced, feet flat on the floor, and then a wonderful image I've learned is to imagine a golden thread coming up through your spine and connecting you to the heavens. So upright posture is that first step. The second step that I do for beginner meditation is to try to identify any areas of attention in our body and just give them a little stretch, right? So for me, I type a lot, so it's almost always my wrists, but some of us might want to do a neck roll, or I have better shoes now, but I used to need to always stretch my toes. Just a brief stretch. Your next step is to set an intention that you're actually going to try to do this, that you're not just going to sit here and think of other things. You're actually going to try to meditate. And so the intention goes something like this. Say it internally. I guess you can say it out loud if you want. For the next minute, I'm working on mental health, discipline, and focus. When I want to think about other things, like my lunch, I won't. I'll note that I want to think about the lunch, but then I'll come back to my center. And the recommended center for beginners is just simply your breath. And so what I do is I count my breaths. I say in one, out one, in two, out two. When I lose my count, I know that I have to work harder on my meditation. So I get distracted and I start thinking about what's for lunch, and I forgot three or four. oops, I need to work on my mental discipline focus. So that's a little bit of a setup. I'll invite you to do it right now. Approximately 3 minutes of silent breathing. Go. Now we're going to move from the focused and centering portion into an imagery portion. So try to maintain your meditative state, but rather than focusing on your breath count, I'm going to give you images to imagine. Howard Thurman said, "Every man wants to be cared for, to be sustained by the assurance that he shares in the watchful and thoughtful attention of others. Not merely or necessarily others in general, but others in particular. He wants to know that however vast and impersonal all life about him may seem, however hard may be the stretch of road on which he is journeying, he is not alone, but the object of another's concern and caring." Please use your imagination. Picture someone who's made you feel this way, someone who made you feel cared for, watched out for, and attended to. Imagine what they look like. Imagine what it feels like to be with them. And bask in that feeling. transition toward a second image. Again, use your power of imagination. The imagination, according to Howard Thurman, shows its greatest powers as the angels of God in the miracle it creates when one man, standing on his own ground, is able, while there, to put himself in another man's place, to send his imagination forth to establish a point of focus in another man's spirit, and from that vantage point, so to blend with the other's landscape that what he sees and feels is authentic. This is the great adventure of human relations. So let's try a little bit of that. Picture someone that you've had difficulty with, someone who's caused problems in your life. Use the power of your imagination to think about what they might be going through. Acknowledge that the reasons for why they do what they do might be authentic. And then this is a real challenge, but if you can, remember back to the feeling you were basking in with your loved one. Imagine extending some of that care, some of that feeling toward the difficult person in your life. And then when you're ready, please open your eyes and give yourself a little pat on the back for giving a real try to your first meditation, most of us, and I'll wrap up with a conclusion here. I'm just going to come back to my thesis. According to Thurman, reconciliation only comes from one place. It comes from a heart that's at peace. How do we get a heart that's at peace? We got to slow down our lives. Take time out. Like, when was the last time you paid attention to your breath and did nothing else? Most Americans would say never. So when we slow down our lives with things like that, discipline, meditation, and prayer, that starts to get us over ourselves. It gets us over our pride and judgment, and we can start to open up opportunities or openings for a relationship, even with the difficult people in our lives. When it gets really difficult, like with social protests and violence, Thurman teaches us that violence doesn't have to be met with more violence. It can be absorbed, and haters can be gentled. How do we do that? We renounce the basic primate instincts or animal instincts of fear of retaliation, and instead offer everybody ourselves, offer the self-gift of care, patience, and understanding. And so I'll stop there, and I have 6 minutes for Q&A. Thank you.